The Weekly Connect
on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect, and it's a bank holiday special. Yes, we're here through this hour going back over some of the stories, the conversations and the calls we've been getting from you, the great British public, on the subject of blind and partial sight. Yeah, this is your show if you're blind or partially sighted, or if you know someone who is affected by sight loss in some way, then this is also the programme for you. Coming up this hour, we're going to go back over some of those interviews and discussions we've had, in particular talking about travel assistance. We're going to be talking about voting in the upcoming election. And do you fancy getting into a conversation about astronomy? All that plus more on the way.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
So welcome along for another week, and we kick things off with a phone call we got from Carol Holmes the other week. Carol's in Blackpool, and she wanted to tell us all about the issues of cars parking on the pavements.
Oh, hello, I'm Carol Holmes in Blackpool, and I'm a guide dog owner. And up until 5 years ago, I could walk about safely. Blackpool has lovely wide pavements, and it was a joy. But over the last 5 years, I am really struggling, and other guide dog owners in Blackpool, but I believe it is, you know, a problem nationally as well. Cars, for some unknown reason, have decided it's their right to park high on the pavements. There was a time when they could park just with two wheels on the pavement. Now they park two-thirds of the car on the pavement. And during the spring and summer and autumn, quite often, the overhanging bushes, and there's more and more of them, my solution was that my daughter dropped letters through their letterbox just to make them aware that if I was going along a pavement, the actual bushes were meeting the cars. So, of course, my dog is trained, if he sees it as an obstacle, to guide me to the curb, walk into the road, walk round the car, rejoin the pavement and follow on our route. But I actually don't like walking in the road these days because the traffic is so speedy. Seems a lot quicker. And also it's quieter. I can't hear them the same, the motors. The other thing is that cars, they don't have the flexible wing mirrors now. They're solid, and I'm forever having bruises on my forearm. And if it's a big vehicle, luckily it's only happened to me once, I got the most awful bruise on my top of my arm. In fact, my daughter took a picture of it and we sent it to the council, because those big vehicles, their wing mirrors are solid, but they're also on an arm. I actually was just grateful it wasn't my head. The other thing is they will park on the corners, so your dog can't find a corner to cross, and you find your dog is crossing diagonally, and which actually can be very disorientating. Doesn't take much to disorientate me. I've also had the problem of twice now cars reversing out of their driveways. And because there's a busy road nearby and I've got the noise of all the cars, I didn't hear them. And, well, both of them hit me, but they didn't hurt me because my dog had pulled me. And both of them, when I stopped, banged on the car, said they didn't see me. Now, that really alarmed me. I mean, aren't you meant to check the pavement before you reverse out of your driveway? I thought you were. And then the other thing is, the cars, some cars, they drive up on the pavement in front of you and open their door. My poor dog's been hit on the head with the door. Anyway, in Blackpool, I must say, the Highways Committee are listening to me, and I've got a meeting with them on Wednesday. What I'm hoping for with my meeting is that at long last, the council will realise that the first 4 foot of the pavement from the wall should be for pedestrians. And I've not even mentioned the bins, but we won't go there. But definitely that's what I'm hoping for. And eventually for a street charter for Blackpool, which the RNIB campaign lady is going to help me with.
Thank you for that, Carol. And if you've got a suggestion on maybe a solution that you've found to getting cars to stop parking on pavements and basically getting in the way, then you should get in touch with us. The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. This is the Weekly Connect, of course, on RNIB Connect Radio. And this week it's a bank holiday special. We're taking a look back at some of the issues, stories and conversations we've had over the past few weeks. Recently, I caught up with Liz Frankland. Now, Liz Frankland is a big fan of astronomy, among other things, and she wonders if you are too. Liz, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, yeah, we're just talking a bit about astronomy and making the universe more accessible. That sounds quite big, doesn't it? Sounds like quite a challenge in some respects. You know, some of us can't get access to a taxi. I'm talking about the universe. But we're not talking necessarily about going, travelling and traversing the universe. We're talking more about the idea of just understanding it as a pastime, as a hobby, as a lot of people do who are sighted. I guess the question is, well, why can't we?
Well, exactly, why can't we? Just because you can't actually look through a telescope and observe the night sky doesn't mean that you're not interested in the things that they've discovered, certainly on things like the Rosetta mission to that comet whose name I can't remember, Asimenko with a load of numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, that was interesting, finding out what they could find out about the comet. And then there's the Cassini mission to Saturn, and the Voyager mission that went out the solar system, just to name a few. So there are plenty of things to learn about if you're interested in things like geology and science, because then you can find out about the nature of these new worlds that these missions are going to. So you might not be able to literally see them, but there's no reason to not be interested in it. You might just be as interested in things like that on Earth and how volcanoes work and, you know, things like that. So why not be interested in that kind of thing in space?
Yeah, exactly. And you were quite keen, quite a while back actually, to set up a group, you know, so other people like you who've got that kind of mindset could get together and talk about it.
Well, the thing is, I really do like the idea of talk and support. I think it was a good idea, and I think it could be utilised much further than it's been. I know there are book groups and there are social groups and people who talk about benefits and that kind of thing, but I think sometimes it's nice to get away from what you might call the usual things that visually impaired people talk about in groups. And I thought that this was just something a bit different, and it's a good way of people who are like-minded getting together without having to worry about getting on a train or, as you said earlier, getting in a taxi. You can just talk to people over the phone. And, you know, there aren't many people, I think, who are probably into astronomy, but they probably feel a bit isolated and they haven't got anybody to talk to about it. So I thought this might be quite a good idea. I had actually been involved with a couple of other talk and support groups about something different, and it had come up that there were a number of people who would be interested in a talk and support group about astronomy, and that's why I suggested that I might facilitate one. I couldn't claim to be an expert on astronomy. There's a lot of things I don't know, so the idea was that we could share about with our knowledge.
Yeah.
So I might be able to learn something, but I might also be able to give knowledge to other people.
But it's that thing, isn't it? You know, I mean, so I for years, and I openly admit this, I was a radio jingles anorak growing up, you know, as a radio guy, and, you know, spending 10, 15 minutes of my life with another radio jingles anorak was like the greatest 15 minutes of my life, because we'd be able to talk about stuff on a level that not everybody else thought we were nuts, but, you know, we loved it. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's sometimes just about escaping away to somewhere and talking about something really with people who get it, who understand it. You know, and as you say, it might be only a few people, but those few people, well, who else are they going to talk to?
Absolutely. I think, yes, the options for talking about something as a little bit specialist like astronomy, the options aren't great. So, yes, I think this would actually give people an outlet to share a hobby that they don't have anybody else to share it with.
What about, this is just a little side note, I guess, but what about magazines for you? I mean, I know R&IB Newsagent have a number of magazines, but are there any specific to science and astronomy that sort of are accessible to you? Do you find that world difficult?
There were two. There's New Scientist, which covers all kinds of things. I mean, there are astronomy articles in it, but there are a whole range of other things as well. I found that a little bit too much because it's a weekly one. It just means you've got to put aside about an hour and a half every week just to listen to New Scientist. And I found that a little bit stressful because I've got a busy life and I haven't got time to be doing that.
Fair enough.
They did Astronomy Now, which came out once a month, and that was better, and that was specifically, obviously, about astronomy. But I then got a letter from R&IB saying that it had been discontinued. So, as far as I'm aware, there isn't a specifically astronomy magazine in an available format anymore.
Okay, so we need to find out why that magazine's no longer there, do we? I mean,
I would certainly like to know.
Yeah, well, we'll get that question put to R&IB Newsagent. We'll get that question put to R&IB Newsagent for you for next week, okay? And we'll see if we can get an answer to that. One thing I guess might be a question some sighted people might wonder, and I think I'm going to ask you this question because you might not be asked this by anyone else, and they might be terrified to ask this, and it seems a fair question. Why does somebody who's no sight at all have any fascination in this?
Well, I suppose it comes back to what I said earlier about you might just be interested in the way things work. So you might not necessarily be able to aesthetically see it visually, but you might be interested in how rock strata works or what the components of water are. So, you might have an interest in chemistry and biology as well. I don't think it has to be visual. And I suppose, to be honest, a lot of things aren't visual. There are some things that are so far away that they're observed by radio telescopes and that it's all done by sort of radio signals and stuff. And I do believe there is actually a blind astronomer out there who actually does study. I can't remember exactly what it is that she does study, but it's all done auditorily. Everything that was mapped out visually for her sighted colleagues, they actually know how to actually transpose it into an audible format for her to research, which I found quite fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all a bit beyond me because it was all mathematical stuff. But
yeah, so you're like me with astronomy. I just want to hear about the planets and hear about the stars and have this image built in my head. It's when they start getting to the numbers, I just, right, okay.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit like that with the numbers. I'm much more interested, to say, in the geology and the geography of these places and what they're made up of, the chemical components and things. And as I say, often you don't need sight to appreciate that. As a sighted astronomer, there would be a lot of things that you wouldn't have access to visually because the visual images aren't there. Obviously, they can be reproduced in some sort of visual format for the benefit of sighted people, but it's not the real thing.
No.
If that makes sense.
So if people are wanting to get involved, what will get them to do? I mean, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, I'd love to do this, actually, this really appeals to me, then, get in touch with us here at The Weekly Connect. And the email address is theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. And we'll put you in touch with Liz. And that's how we start this, I guess.
Yes, thank you. That would be good. I'd be glad to hear of all the astronomers out there who might want to talk to me.
And I think what's great about it as well, though, Liz, is that it opens up the door for other people who've got other hobbies and interests. Maybe radio jingle anoraks. I'm just saying. But, they could get together and talk about different things and maybe just opens up the idea. Like you say, this idea that, the talk and support from R&IB, which is a brilliant service, no doubt about it, just top of the line, brilliant service. And I say that as someone who's used the service, not someone who, works for R&IB. Generally, I just think it's a great service. But what I found is that you're right, the topics are quite limiting. And it's up to us to come up with the new topics and say, well, actually, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? And I think that's a great one. And if anyone has other ideas, then, you know, this might open up that option for them. So thank you for sharing that, Liz. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking me.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
And it's a bank holiday special this week. We're taking a look back at some of the stories, conversations and more that we've had here on the programme. And we turn now to something rather different because, you know, if you're blind or partially sighted, you often think there are things you can't do. And in fact, we're often told there's things in life we can't do. Well, one man's tried to defy a lot of that since losing some of his sight. Red Sale is our Read On Air presenter here on RNIB Connect Radio. And as well as reading lots of books, he loves to climb as well. So he decided to take our reporter Leanne Coyle on a bit of rock climbing to show her how it's done.
Red, hi, I'm Leanne.
Hi Leanne, how are you?
Pleased to meet you. Finally.
Good to meet you.
So here, you're going to take me climbing then?
Yep, off to the castle.
Great. So it's just a few minutes walk from here, isn't it?
It is, very close.
Okay, great. Let's get going. So Red, just as we're making our way to the climbing centre on this really horrible rainy afternoon in London, tell me a bit about your level of sight. How did you lose your sight?
Well, I've got retinitis pigmentosa, which I was diagnosed with when I was 19. I guess I've probably lost about 97% of my sight. I can still distinguish between light and dark, but I can't see any detail. It's all very hazy, and it's a bit like looking through a keyhole into a smoke-filled room. I get glimpses of parts of things, but they have to stay still for quite a long time for me to be able to work out what they are. So looking at rock faces is kind of ideal because they don't move very much.
Rock faces for climbing, of course.
Yes, so it's gone gradually over the last nearly 30 years, so I've had time to get used to it. It's just frustrating, really. I think anybody who has experienced gradual sight loss would know exactly what I'm talking about. You lose the ability to do things that you used to be able to do. What I like about climbing is that actually it's not just a visual activity. There's a lot of feel and balance, and there is the potential to improve, which kind of, I feel, helps in the battle against the frustration of losing my sight.
Were you a climber before you started to lose your sight at the age of 19?
Well, I started rock climbing when I was about 13 at school. You know, I was getting quite good by the age of 18, 19. But when I got my diagnosis, I thought, well, if I can't trust my sight, how can I expect other people to trust me? So I hung up my harness and sulked for about 20 years. And it was only because my daughter wanted to have her 9th birthday party at a local climbing wall, 2009, that, you know, I got to the wall, and the other parents were sort of ogling these, you know, buff-bodied climbing instructors, and I was off groping the bumps and curves on the climbing wall, thinking, oh, I've missed this. And I spoke to the climbing instructor, and he went, well, I can't see that being blind's going to make any difference. So he took it as a challenge to improve his teaching abilities, and I took it as a challenge to try and lose all those pounds that I put on in the 20 intervening years. I'm quite an advocate that anybody who's got a climbing wall near them should just give it a go.
Excellent. Well, that's what we're going to do today, and we've just arrived at the Castle Climbing Centre in North London. Let's get in and get harnessed up and get on a wall.
Thank you.
Here we are.
The sound of the busy climbing wall. Right, so we need a harness around our waist, which we loop the rope through. We'll also need a belay plate and a carabiner to put the rope through. Climbing shoes are always a good idea, although you can climb in trainers as a beginner.
Okay, so we're harnessed up. We've got our carabiners, we've got our water. Let's get to the wall.
Fantastic.
This wall, Red, looks about 20 feet. Is that about the normal size? I mean, I can see there are other much taller walls around.
Yeah, 20 feet's a good one to start off on, assuming that it's got a relatively straightforward route on it. Does it say what the grade of the route is anywhere?
It does. So at the bottom, we've got black is 4, green is 4+, yellow and purple is 5, and blue is 6A.
So a 4A would be a nice, easy starting route, which wouldn't involve anything too gymnastic and which will have good positive holds to hold on to. So a 6A is, you know, it's going to be a tricky climb. I enjoy climbing 6As and 6Bs, but can't climb a huge amount more difficult than that. So I think if we start on a 4 just to warm up on.
Excellent, let's do it then.
Okay.
Red, you were saying earlier that when you climb up a wall, someone has to be at the bottom belaying you.
Yes.
Basically, their weight is countering yours, so if you fall off the wall, their weight will keep you safe.
They will keep you on a relatively taut rope, so that if the climber falls, the inertia of the rope running through the belay plate in a sort of U-shape, and the belayer's hand, in my case the right hand, will pull down on the rope and will arrest his fall, will stop him falling to the ground.
Just in the interest of safety, we do have another experienced climber here who is going to belay you. Jeremy, you're all harnessed up and ready to go. We're just waiting on
yeah.
Red securing his harness. So what have you got here?
There's a carabiner here that clips onto your harness, and then we've got a belay. So the rope goes through that, and when I pull down with my hands the loose end of the rope, that locks the rope, so no one can fall, no one can move at all.
So, Red, you want to do the 5 as a warm-up. Now, I'm reading the chart and it says that's the yellow and purple swirls. I can quite clearly see the holds dotted up the wall here, but how are you going to find them?
Well, this is where you and or Jeremy come in very useful. One of you is going to be my spotter. The system that I use is a clock face system. So if you imagine my tummy button is the centre of the clock, when I reach up with my right arm, I'm reaching up for anything between 12 o'clock and maybe 3 or 4 o'clock. You can direct me that way. Likewise with the feet, they obviously are the sort of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 o'clock. Takes a bit of getting used to, but we should get there.
I might rely on Jeremy to help me out with this one, him being an experienced climber.
That one. That's it.
Okay, up you go.
Right, that one? Right hand down, that's it.
That
left, left hand, that's about 10 o'clock. So further to the left, so and down. That's your next one. And left foot straight up at 11 o'clock.
Left foot?
Yeah.
What have we got next for the left
foot? That's it. Yep.
Okay, so you're just letting Red down the wall now, Jeremy,
yeah? Yeah, slowly lowering him down.
It's almost like he's abseiling back down, isn't he?
That's right. You just need to shuffle your hands down the ropes. You've always got control of the rope. There you go.
Right.
Well, good climb.
Excellent. Nice. How was that for you, Red?
That was very good fun.
You mentioned on the way here that when you found out about your diagnosis of retinitis pigmentosa, you thought that was it for you. And in fact, you did give up climbing for
20 years.
20 years. So, coming back into climbing, how did you have to amend your climbing style?
I think the difficult thing is that actually I do a lot more hanging around in between the moves than a sighted person, because I'm waiting for instructions and I'm having to, you know, process those instructions, work out what's there, grope around for the hold, to be honest. You'll have seen us moving my hand around in spirals looking for the right hold. All that's pretty hard on the, especially the arms, if you're hanging off one arm trying to find the next hold. So I do a lot of strengthening exercises, a lot of arm work and forearm work, that's where, and finger work as well, just to make sure that my arms are strong enough. I always say I'd probably have to be about 115% as fit as anyone else, just because I spend, you know, at least 15% more time hanging off the wall than anybody else. It's very, very good for my balance. My balance is one of those things that I have progressively lost as my sight has gone. But
something
actually,
a lot of people who lose their sight do struggle with it, is balance, and it helps for you.
That's right. I mean, climbing makes me concentrate on putting my weight evenly through my feet, on standing properly. I do a bit of yoga as well, which also helps with my balance. And actually, yoga and climbing are very similar in that way. So actually, I've found climbing very beneficial to my general mobility.
You know, after 20 years of not climbing, you got back into it, and you achieved your a lifelong ambition of climbing the Old Man of Hoy.
Yes,
in the Orkneys.
In the Orkneys. That happened in 2013. I'd fallen in love with the idea of climbing the Old Man of Hoy when I saw a documentary about Chris Bonington's ascent of it. He was the first person to climb it. And I thought, wow, that's a kind of a cathedral of rock, and it's in the UK, and I want to go and climb that.
Give us an idea of the scale of this wall. I mean, what is it like?
It is 450 feet tall. It's, for those who have sight, it's kind of the shape and size of the London Gherkin building. It's it is an enormous pillar of rock. It's the size of a sort of 40-story, a 24-story block of flats. And the Old Man has a huge bulging belly in the middle that you have to climb out of a crack and over this bulging belly, and then you climb on. And it's a tough climb. It's this pillar of rock rising out of the Atlantic off the Orkney island of Hoy.
So you'd have to deal with wind as well, I'm sure.
We were very lucky. We got quite a calm day. But there's wind. There's all sorts of seabirds that like to nest on it. And things called fulmars, which are seabirds that have a very nasty habit of regurgitating their fish supper all over your head when you get too close to them. They can projectile vomit up to a metre and a half.
Oh, God.
You might not want to put that in the show.
If you didn't have enough to contend with.
And it took me 5 hours to climb. It was quite a mission.
Well done. Now, what we're standing in front of is not quite the Old Man of Hoy, but I'm going to give it a go anyway.
Fantastic.
I'm harnessed up, ready to climb.
I'm taking the rope, so you're on belay.
Excellent. So if I fall, you will catch me.
Yes, absolutely. but you're not going to fall, because it's a nice straightforward route. First, identify two good footholds.
Okay, right.
And two comfortable handholds. So handholds where you feel comfortable, you're not stretching too far, you're actually in balance.
Okay.
And then you're moving one limb at a time.
Yeah.
So you should always have 3 points of contact. So
always decide what, have 3 points of contact.
Yeah, decide what you're going to move first.
Mm-hmm.
See your next hold. Then I tend to move a leg up every time I've moved an arm.
Okay.
If I can.
Right. Excellent. Oh wow, I feel quite high up.
Yeah, fantastic. Take a breath, and then work out where you're going to move your hand or foot next.
Okay, up.
Okay, Leanne, just out to the left and move on up. Nice smooth movement, well done. Nearly at the top. Well done, that was a fantastic climb. Oh, are you hooked?
That was really, I have to say I was pretty scared, even though you said this isn't a very tall wall, but I was very scared at the top, but the feeling of being up there is amazing. And I think I'm definitely going to hang back in the climbing centre and try out a few more walls.
Well, fantastic. When you want to go and climb the Old Man of Hoy, you know where I am.
Yeah, next step, the Old Man of Hoy. Thanks so
fantastic.
Much, Fred.
Thank you.
Well, rather you than me, that is Leanne Coyle there, our reporter on the Weekly Connect, talking to Red Sail about going rock climbing. Wow. Yeah, you can do anything when you're blind. That's what they tell us. You can tell us what you think. You can get in touch, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Well, to go rock climbing, you usually have to go somewhere. You have to get out of the house, at least, don't you? And one of the big problems that we face as blind or partially sighted people is getting access to decent travel. It might be bus, train, or plane. But one of the ways a lot of us do that is through a thing called travel assistance, which is a fantastic thing when it works. Let's hear now from two people, Hussein and Amanda, who joined us recently in the studio to tell us their experiences, in fact, their most recent experiences of travel assistance.
Hi, Amanda. It's really good to see you. How was your holiday?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad, apart from the fact that when I come back from Gatwick, the man checked that boarding passes five times and we're just about to leave the flight.
Wow, you flew back from Gatwick. I thought you didn't like flying.
I don't really, but I thought, I think it might be convenient and it's going to be a bit cheaper. So and the assistance does work. There are things I don't like. I mean, as I say, I do realise that we have to be there pretty early, but, you know, sometimes if you're there 2 hours before, you're sort of, there is a lot of hanging around that I don't like, but I'll accept that. Security.
Yeah, I mean, I fly myself, so I know exactly what you mean. And who likes hanging around at an airport 2 hours in advance? But, you know, like you say, people really are great. And if you plan ahead, it tends to work quite well. I've also flown abroad as well, and I find that the service is quite good. Mm-hmm. As long as you just organised. Did you find any problems on your way back?
Not really problems. I mean, obviously, you're never quite sure exactly what's going to happen, you know, when you go through security, because, you know, you don't know what's, you know, if the thing's going to go off, what's, you know, if it does go off, what triggers it, and you sort of think, well, and I think I've been searched a few times because either something metal's gone off, and I think, this is a wee bit scary.
Oh, but tell me about it. It's an absolute nuisance knowing what to pack. But the first time I went through the thing, I walked into the detector, and I thought I broke the thing. I was terrified. But the people were really good and helped me out. And like you say, I've been searched a couple of times, but generally it goes without a problem. And, you know, it's something that everybody has to go through, so I suppose we just have to live with it.
We do. I haven't quite got used to it yet. I'm still always a bit... So that, you know, when I go through security, I think, oh, I'm a bit sort of stressed out. And then once you're sort of there, you think, oh, okay, that was okay. I mean, it's fine when the assistance person sort of reassures you and says, oh, you know, it's okay. It's just, you know, you're not going to be arrested or anything like that. Because one time I came back from Gatwick, actually, when I was going to see somebody, and... then everything was going fine. And I thought, oh yeah, this is good. This is easy. And then some very efficient person came up and said, "What's your date of birth?" Like that, and I thought, oh dear,
Jesus, that's terrible. What did he want?
Well, I don't know what I said. I says, "Why do you want it? We just need it." Okay, yeah, okay. So I gave it, and I thought, I hope that's going to be the end of it. But luckily, it was, and wow. I was able to just go back on my way.
I suppose there's always going to be somebody that's a bit like that. But from what you're saying, generally, it sounds like you've had a good experience now, and you certainly sound a lot more confident.
Oh, yeah, I'm a lot better. As I say, I mean, I think, you know, these things, you know, are just slightly problematic. But I think, you know, the more I do it, the more used to it I'll get.
I think you're right. I'm going to visit my grandparents in Tanzania with my mum in about 3 weeks' time. And I've booked assistance, but it wasn't the easiest process booking assistance in the first place. Because I booked with a travel agent and there was absolutely nothing said about it at all. And I thought then I'd try and call the airline, but see, trying to find the number of an airline was trying to find a needle in a haystack. And I'm still waiting for them to get back to me. But from what I've known in the past, eventually the whole thing clicks together. But I really wish it was easier to do that. Mm. It would be nice if you book the thing and you could just tick a box or something to say, I'm visually impaired, I need assistance. And then that was just passed through rather than having to go from pillar to post.
Yeah, that would be an awful lot easier, because if you're having to deal with two companies, you're just never quite sure if all the information's down right. That would stress me out, because you sort of do need things to be, well, as simple as possible, just to save on the stress.
How do you get to Gatwick?
Well, obviously fly from Dicey Airport, which is...
No, I mean, how do you get to the airport at the other end when you're coming back? Do you take the train?
No, I just take a taxi. It's quite near, so I just do that.
But isn't that difficult, trying to... You know, how do you get from the taxi to the assistance people? Because there's all this kerfangle about parking nowadays and you can't park close to the airports. How do you manage that?
Well, it's funny, actually, because the times I've actually been, the taxi driver has just taken me in. So I don't know whether they are sort of doing, whether they're sort of just parking and not getting into trouble about it. Because they've taken me into the assistance point and just said, look, you know, this is the blind person, can you just deal with it? And then they've just gone and left me.
I wish it was the same up in Aberdeen, because often when I go, especially over the winter, it's dark in the morning and there's a phone point out in the car park, but I'm never really sure how to describe it. And, okay, you pick up the phone and somebody answers at the other end and you give your name and they say that they'll be out, but it's really not the best waiting out there, especially in the winter and the cold and rain. You're never sure who's coming. And sometimes people are offering to help you, but you're scared to leave in case then the assistance person can't find you. And it would just be nice if everything was a lot more connected. And, you know, other of my friends go to the airport and they get to the airport, they park, they walk through and there's no problem. Everything just runs like clockwork, but it just seems to be this maze that you need to navigate. And don't even get me started about buying things at the airport. I mean, come on, I'm visually impaired, but I've got every right to buy a cola or have a coffee as anyone else. But the first time I flew, I remember I didn't want to ask. I thought I'd be holding them all up. But eventually one of them was kind enough to tell me, and you know, they said, you've got every right to do whatever anyone else wants to do, and if you want a coffee, just tell us. And now I go a little bit early because I get the assistance and I just ask them if they wouldn't mind running me by the cafe and get a little Red Bull. I know I shouldn't have it. It's terrible for terrible for my health, but they're good enough to do that. And it just makes me feel, I suppose, more normal, if that makes any sense. You know, it makes me feel like, you know, someone that wasn't visually impaired would feel, and just makes me feel more like a regular member of society.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I've not done yet. I've not had the nerve to ask them, but maybe I should, sort of, you know, if ever I sort of fancy a coffee or a cola or something, just say, can you sort of take me into the shop? Obviously, you've got to do it after you get through security, because you can't take that through. But yeah, maybe I should do.
Well, absolutely. Why shouldn't you? I mean, anyone else would. And to be honest, some of those muffins in some of the coffee shops are to die for.
Oh, are they? Oh, well, in that case, I've really got to go and do it then.
I really recommend the triple chocolate one, but don't tell the dentist.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Yes, I like the sound of that. Yeah, I think I'll have to do that, because you want to try and make your experience as relaxed as possible, don't you?
Well, this is it. And I used to travel a lot by train before I started flying, and the train was good, but you had all these problems with delays. And to be honest, you know, even though I love traveling by train, it's now just starting to cost an absolute fortune. And, you know, flying down to London or within the UK or even flying abroad has become so cheap now that you just want to be able to do it and head off on holiday as and when you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
I just hope that, you know, someday someone will come up with a way to make everything more interconnected. And, flying will become even more enjoyable than it already is. If you can do it, then surely anyone can.
Well, you would hope so, because, I mean, I still don't find it as relaxing as I do the train, I've got to say. But I think it will get there.
What do you mean? How do you, how would you think that you would feel more comfortable?
Well, I think it might be just the structure of it, because you know, you've got to, you know, with the plane you just sort of go into the place, you sort of get, you know, that's the ticket office, you sort of you say, oh, I'm going to such and such. Oh, okay, fine, just sit down, and I'll get the assistance person, get on the plane, end of. And that just seems to be, that seems to be me. I sit with a book, sort of with the plane, you sort of, you sort of do that, but then there's the security that I'm still not quite over yet. And then there's all this hanging around, and, oh, you've where do you go to the plane now? But then you're sort of waiting, sort of, and you think, what's going on? Why am I sitting here and waiting?
I know what you mean.
And you think,
you sometimes wonder. I remember one time I was in Bergen, and I was waiting to get my connection onwards to Copenhagen, and I was sitting in the gate, you know, wondering if I was in the wrong place, or you know, had I missed a flight? You know, these time differences. Sometimes you never remember when to set things, and you're quite. I was sitting there in this empty airport, and it was eerie. I mean, who sits around an empty airport at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, for a flight that's fully booked? And eventually someone did turn up, but I know exactly what you mean. It was a bit nerve-wracking at the time.
It was a bit, because you think, oh, maybe, you know, maybe somebody's taking me to the wrong bit, or, you know, where am I going? But as I say, I suppose these things will iron themselves out, but it is, you know, once I've now that I've started flying, I think, well, it is pretty convenient.
Well, that's fantastic to hear. And, you know, I've always said that, you know, people can be as independent as they want, and it's great to see that, you know, if like I say, if you can do it, anyone can. I suppose for me, the best piece of advice that someone gave me was to be organized and have all my paperwork in advance. And nowadays I've just got the apps on my phone, so I'm not having to faff around with all these bits of paper. Most companies just go in the shredder anyway. But, you know, being organized, plan ahead and knowing where I'm going, and the rest, it just falls into place.
Excellent. I'll certainly take that advice. Yeah, definitely.
Well, let me know if you've got any room for your next trip. I'd love to come along. It's been a while since I've been away.
Certainly will. Absolutely. Mm. Yep, definitely.
Shall we order those teas now?
Yeah, what's a good idea?
excuse me, you two, before you go, and before you get those teas, I just want to bring up one thing that you said, Hussein, that I think a lot of people will be interested in talking about, and that is the comment you made about getting a coffee or getting a donut or a triple chocolate muffin at the...
Oh, they're to die for, Stephen. Oh, if you haven't tried them, you really should. You're missing something.
I have tried them, trust me. But here's the thing. It's not only that, is it? It's shopping as well.
Well, this is it. I mean, I see all the juicy free offers, but unless I've got someone to help me, there's no way of me getting them. And, you know, yeah, I'm used to shopping online, but it's not the same, is it? You go to the airport, you get a shop, and you've got something in your hand and something to take away. And as I say, you know, most assistant staff are happy to help, but you've always got on your mind that there's other passengers there, and it's just this shyness, I suppose, to feel that you're imposing on somebody. I mean, you know, I'm, like I say, they're happy to help, but it's that whole feeling about, you know, always having to ask for something. And, you know, it would be nice if someone just said, and a couple of them have gone, you know, is there anything that you need? And that would just reassure you an awful lot more.
But if you said to them, I want to walk around the electrical store, as I often do, because I love a nosy around the gadgets, you know, I wouldn't necessarily ask. In fact, I haven't ever asked that question, because I think I would be holding them back.
And you'd feel as if you're taking up time for somebody else. Yeah. But it shouldn't be like that. I don't know. Maybe in the future, the way the system works will improve a little bit, so that, I don't know, maybe it integrates with the stores more, so that there's a handover process. So, you know, it would be nice if I could say, oh, take me to the electronics store and maybe come back for me in half an hour, and then the store folk can take over, just as you were going to High Street.
But of course, Amanda, the fear is, as you've felt this as well, that they don't come back for you. That's a big fear.
Well, that is a big fear. Yeah, because, I mean, airports are big places, and there just seems to be lots of different bits in them that you sort of go, and that would definitely be a fear of mine. But if they did sort of say, you know, is there anything you need, that would sort of help, because I must admit, I don't like asking. If they don't sort of say, and they just sit you down, I probably wouldn't ask.
I like what you said about the airport being a big place, because knowing my luck, I'd end up exactly where you're not supposed to go.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, go and enjoy your tea. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Mine's milk and two, by the way, just so you know. This is the Weekly Connect. It's Bank Holiday Monday. We're listening into some of the conversations we had over the past couple of weeks. Thank you for joining me. It's Stephen Scott here. On next week's show, we want to talk about the general election and, in particular, accessible voting. How have you found voting in the last general election? And what's your thoughts going forward? Do you have any concerns or fears that you might not be able to vote independently or privately? Well, RNIB have told us in the past couple of weeks that they think that voting in the UK in 2017 is easier now more than ever.
I think things are improving. But if you are blind or partially sighted, you know, many people that do get out to vote say, what a good feel it gives you. You're part of the community, you're out there, you're casting your democratic right that people have fought in two world wars to get. You know, democracy is so important. And yet, for us, it's paper-based. And, you know, lots of people talk about what's going on in other countries, why can't we have electronic voting, X, Y, Z. There's all sorts of things going around the world. But the voting system we have in this country at the moment is based around paper. And so what we can do about that is to do our best. And some polling stations seem to do better than others, according to blind and partially sighted people we speak to up and down the country, whilst other people struggle. And in a nutshell, what it is when you turn up at your polling station, and if you can't read the ballot paper at all, like me, then you need the tactile template. And if you've got more than one ballot, you know, some elections you're having to do a council election and a general election and something else, then you do need a different tactile template for each ballot, because the ballot papers are designed slightly differently. And you do need to take that tactile template into the booth with you. You may need assistance in placing that template over the top of the ballot paper so it lines up with the boxes that are marked on the ballot paper. And then you're going to need someone to tell you what the candidate list is and what number on the tactile template corresponds to the person you want to vote for. And herein lies the problem, because if you want to be totally secret about your vote, you're going to have to sort of try and avoid revealing to the polling station staff who are assisting you what candidate you want to vote for. It can be accessible. It can be. But not if the template isn't available, or if something goes wrong with the template and the polling station staff haven't checked or prepared themselves to assist you to use it.
That's Hugh Huddy there from RNIB talking recently on the Weekly Connect. He was telling us that he thinks that voting is improving, at least the attempts to make voting more accessible is improving. Well, you can tell us your thoughts on that. We're very keen to hear your thoughts. You can email the show, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Tell us what you think about accessible voting in 2017. Now, we get lots of your calls to the show, as well as your emails, and Rosie got in touch with us to tell us about her issues and difficulties she faced when trying to find employment.
Hi, Stephen. This is Rosie in the UK. When I first started losing my eyesight a few years ago in 2011, I was actually doing a fine art degree. I had no idea that my eyesight was going to deteriorate so quickly. And I was also working part-time at Sixth Form College University campus. And when they found out that I was going to get a guide dog, they made quite a big fuss about it. And they said, oh, you can't come back to work till we've sorted out all the health and safety issues. So I had to wait a couple of weeks before I actually came back to work. When I came back to work, they'd moved my desk round the corner to where members of the staff hot desk, like tutors and other members of the staff that worked in the college. So I wasn't sitting with my team, I was sitting on my own most of the time. So really, to me, they just discriminated me. Instead of including me in the team, they sat me somewhere else totally different, because they said, oh, there wasn't enough room for me on the team to sit there with my guide dog. So I couldn't answer the phone or be involved in what the team was doing. So I thought that was discrimination against me rather than involving me in the team as normal. And I wanted to have a screen reader put on my computer. I asked the IT guy so many times, can you put this on? And they just ignored me, basically. So I didn't think they were very accommodating whatsoever. It was a very fast-paced environment, and it just seemed like unless you could produce massive amount of work in a short space of time, they weren't really interested in you. So that was my experience. I left in the end. Thank you. All the best.
Well, thanks for being so honest, Rosie. That was Rosie talking to us a couple of weeks ago on the show on the subject of employment. How do you find getting on in employment? Well, if you have had a better experience or not, then you can tell us. Email theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. It really is your show to talk about the things you want to talk about. And one area we've had a lot of interest in over the past few weeks is the subject of blind yoga. Lots of you out there are keen to do it. Well, Padma Cherian got in touch to tell us her thoughts and what she did in Milton Keynes to try and encourage more blind people there to get into yoga.
Hello, I'm Padma. I've been registered as blind for the past 20 years or so. Of late, recently, I was diagnosed with arthritis, and it was getting worse. I went for a physiotherapy, and the physiotherapist asked, why don't you start yoga? I thought that is a good idea.
Standing side twists. Come into a standing position with the feet a little wider than hip distance apart. Begin to swing the arms side to side. Let the head follow the movement of the torso.
It is difficult for a blind person to go to yoga classes for sighted people. So I thought, why don't we start yoga for the blind?
And begin to slow the action down. In slow motion, coming back to stillness, close the eyes and notice what you feel within your body.
A couple of friends also are interested, so I was looking for a teacher. And one of the technology for RNIB technology volunteers who comes to help me with computers now and again, he said he is a trained yoga teacher. I said, could you help us?
Notice how you are breathing and take several full breaths. Relaxed, in and out.
When I find a yoga teacher for me, I would try and get other blind people interested in yoga for benefits yoga has for health. Actually, yoga is good not only for physical health, but for mental health also. A lot of blind people suffer from depression, so I thought it would be good holistically.
Notice if the head feels centered, not turned to the left or the right.
I put an advert in the local talking newspaper, and several people responded. Couple of them, they were quite nervous about joining because they don't belong to any social group. And not only that, they have, apart from visual impairment, they have hearing impairment also. So when I told them, I myself suffer with dual sensory disability. So they will be in good company. I think that they gave them some encouragement and confidence. And I'm glad I got such people involved as well.
This may feel comfortable or it may feel awkward in places. Notice how your body feels in this position.
Finding a venue was a bit of a challenge because it has to be accessible. I found a venue. Unfortunately, it takes only about 6 people, and I have more members interested. So I found another venue, which is not only it takes more people, up to 12, but also it is free of charge.
Bring your awareness to your arms and hands. Feel free to wiggle around until you find the balance left and right. Take a few more breaths, full and deep, before you release this position.
If we have more people interested, I'll have to look for an even larger venue. I hope I will have to do that, because it will be nice to get more people involved and enjoy the benefits of yoga, not only for physical but mental health also. That is our new project for the new year, 2017.
Thanks, Padma. Padma talking there about blind yoga. Right, we've got time for just one call before we go, and this is from Louise, who got in touch with us to tell us why she felt foolish in April.
Hiya, Steve. Stephen. Louise here. It is great to know that you're not alone when you do end up talking to inanimate objects. I said excuse me to a barrier. I was walking down the road where I live and they were doing some roadworks and they put this kind of barrier across the road. I said excuse me to this bollard 3 times and it was only when a teenage boy who was walking the same way kind of came up behind me and went, "That's a bollard!" I wanted the floor to open up and swallow me. I was like, okay. It's quite amazing, actually, how people can be taken in by the silliest of comments. I was at school and I went to a school for the blight or for the visually impaired, Dorton House, which sadly no longer exists. And the deputy head, we had a graffiti board at the end of one of the corridors for people to draw little murals and stuff on. And it was painted over once a month or once a fortnight. Anyway, this particular April the 1st, 2000, I think it was, in assembly, the deputy head told us that we all had to be careful because they'd taken the wrong kind of paint to paint over this graffiti board. And when people walked past it, it had a rather high alcohol content. And when people walked past it, they might feel dizzy and a bit faint. And, you know, to try not to breathe too much until you've gone past this board. And the amount of people that actually put their hands up and said, actually, when I was passing that board this morning, I did feel a little bit queasy. And, yeah, I felt a little bit sick this morning. And there were loads of people who absolutely swore that this paint made them feel a bit bleh. And come lunchtime, we were sitting there having our dinners. The deputy head came back in, blew a whistle. Everybody went quiet because that only ever used to happen when it was something serious. You know, they wanted to talk to us about something serious. And he just went, you know that thing in assembly this morning? April Fool. And I can't see anything, but I can picture the look on everyone's faces when they realised that they had been tricked into thinking that the graffiti board, the paint to go over the graffiti board had too high an alcohol content and people were physically feeling sick when they were walking past it. Oh, it was so funny. But the most embarrassing one, which happened to me, happened, I used to live in the Republic of Ireland and at one point I had a job interview and my last guide dog, she had a particular fondness for carrying things. It was usually soft toys. But very occasionally, she would carry other things, like one of my slippers or a pair of clean socks or something like that. And on this particular occasion, I put a harness and a lead on. And then I got distracted. Someone rang me. I think it was someone from the agency that I was going to interview with to make sure that I was still okay to come on that particular day, that particular time. And I was like, yeah, I'm on my way. Picked up the handle, the harness, and I've gone into town, got the bus into town. And everybody was saying hello to me. And you know when you can hear in people's voices that they're sort of, you know, hiya, laughing a bit, you know. Not laughing at you, but kind of like, that's unusual.
Well, look, Rosie, I'm going to have to cut you off, but thank you for your call and thank you for listening. That's The Weekly Connect, back next Monday at 1:00.